Hey there, it's Ben. I'm sorry to announce that this is the last episode we have with Becca Black. We valued her contribution to the show and wish her great luck on both her current and future endeavors. Also, we've had a very welcome influx to our Patreon this month. I want to give a shout out to Matt Vagert for supporting us, and you can be like them at patreon.com/theHeidiandWhite. Thank you, and now on to the show.
Okay, Ben, what are we blowing up today? A stray asteroid? An Imperial shuttle? An explosive barrel jettisoned from a decoy craft that'll set off a series of explosions and land us in a trap? Because if you see one of those around, I could go for some trap solving right about now.
Well, I did see that raider off chasing a squad of wildlings that could use some trickery and hijinks. Those rebels keep using those Clone Wars era antiques. When will they learn? This is going to be a high-caliber tale from the Heidian Way. We're your hosts, Ben Yendel.
And Becca Black.
This week we're going to talk about one of the things that I have run into several times, and I've also observed this in a few other weird spaces, where to start up a campaign, like a campaign I'm planning on have run for like 6 months, maybe more, is my players get all their characters together and they're all great. They've got an idea on how they're wanting their characters to be. They've kind of sort of planned out their own interactions with other characters of this one is sort of being the mother hen to that one. This one is being the closed off assassin that is a Stark drop in. And you've got this opera singing hut that's also doing a lot of pop covers for some reason.
People are allowed to have multiple interests.
Not really complaining, I'm just going on. Sometimes you have a large concept that then, as a GM, you're not really sure, so the very first session is based around what you want. Like, yeah, the very first small adventure is just sort of this almost bottle episode where it's not greatly going to affect anything unless something takes, but you're wanting to have the players start interacting, starting to see what sort of different relationships are going to grow. Who is going to be the one who's actually the big talker instead of just being assuming it's going to be the face? Just because someone has a high presence doesn't mean they're actually going to be the face of the party. It just means they're the ones who are going to be doing the charm roles.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can have a party lead to sort of emerge from it. Or you can have a nice, quiet person who is playing a Gand as being a Gand who talks about themselves in the third person, as only Gands can. The wonderful little aliens they are. Like, even Zuckus talks about himself in the third person. It's amazing. In my experience, the very starts of things is the GM writing for the GM. Even if it's a bunch of scenes that, oh yes, I'm going to be the one setting these hazards in front of them, and I'm going to be putting through the ringer because we're starting in media res. There's blaster fire going all over the place. And there's explosions over there. They're trying to run to the ship to protect their cargo. It's still a scene that, yes, it has a lot of action to it, but it's how are these players dealing with doing this? Especially they have no context for this at all. Why is any of this happening? We don't know. Just go with it. Then, after like a session or two sessions that are in the books, that's when you start getting an idea of this is what the party is. This is what the player characters are. This is how they're acting with a few of these NPCs. And then you can start actually planning for what the players are going to do because they've started to show you what they do.
I think that this definitely applies particularly when you're running for people that you haven't run for before.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, you cannot help but write for yourself in the session zero or session one, the proverbial pilot episode, where it's just an introduction to the setting and the action, and you're getting a feel for everything. You're testing the waters. But I feel like, to a certain extent, if it's a party that you've played with a lot, if you know these people really well, you're going to have a better handle on things from the get-go about what directions they tend towards. Like, for example, my masks group, we have a couple different games running together, and they're all like different systems and different ones of us GMing. And we're able to use what we know about each other more than what we know about the characters. In a way, that makes things a lot more satisfying than writing things for the characters, because then you can just sort of plunk the characters down into any situation and see how they would react to it and how they would problem solve. But if you plunk a character down into a situation where it's not like the character would know a certain thing, but the player appreciates it, then it's its own kind of gratifying. But it is definitely important, I think, to have that sort of testing the waters session or episode or whatever you want to call it, in order to suss out exactly who that character is, because who the character is in play often differs from who they are in concept, because I might have a great idea, a great concept for a fast-talking, wheeling and dealing, lucky, charming character, but I'm not any of those things. And so I might find it hard to play that in action. That character concept might be whittled down to charmingly awkward and really amp up the luck aspect of that character. Like, player roles within the party definitely do vary based on the circumstances, because I know I talk about my Masks game a lot. I love it so much. But in that Masks game, we all assumed that my friend Madge would be the face of the party because she's playing a legacy character. And so she's a well-known hero already.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, comes from a very important hero family. And so we were like, oh, okay, so that's going to be the face of the party. It turns out that our shy, nervous Hulk style transformed character ended up being the face of the party because he has a more steadfast moral compass than any of the rest of us. Speaking of faces of the party, we actually evenly distribute the face time between each character pretty evenly. So it's not all one person doing the talking and everybody else sort of standing around. We all get a chance to do the talking and we get to see how spectacularly that fails.
Well, and sometimes that's really important.
Yeah.
I kind of hate to do it in the D&D sense, but okay, so every now and then, the fighter has to be the one to step up and talk. And sometimes that's going to work out.
Yeah, sometimes that's what's going to be necessary, because, like, a grizzled old warrior who's dubious about joining your party isn't going to listen to the fast-talking, wheeling-and-dealing gambler character. He's going to listen to the fellow fighter who knows what is going to motivate a warrior character.
Also, who they have a bit of a bond with, and who that they can tell wouldn't be able to charm them if their life depended on it.
Yeah, it's like, I can tell that you would be a very bad liar, and because of that, I know that you're not lying to me, so I'll trust you. But that guy, I don't trust that guy as far as I can throw him.
Which, even so, is still a fair distance, because we are talking about a veteran fighter here. It's like, yeah, easily going like 20 feet as they bounce off the floor a few times.
I could throw that guy like a spear, and he would go so far, and I still wouldn't trust him.
Exactly. That's also kind of the idea, is sometimes it's people of a kind talking to each other.
Yeah.
And that is going to matter more. It's at this time where yes, in Star Wars you do have the 5 social skills. But even then, there's technically an entire other set of social skills, which are also kind of research skills and the knowledge skills.
Mm-hmm.
Almost tacitly, you have as a knowledge education as a bureaucracy skill. Like, this is how you deal with any of the big higher-ups. Like, right. That's one of the reasons why researcher can be useful, is because this is how you deal with bureaucracy. You use knowledge education to sort of wheedle your way through all the little form fillings, ins, outs, and signing things in triplicate. And that's a fairly useful example of, you could do that as a just brute force charm check if you're trying to charm this person behind the wicket at a DMV. Or you could be the person who's able to decipher these forms that are in front of you that look like they're in High Galactic.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can have a fighter and fighter essentially talking about their giant swords and using melee for it. Like, melee doesn't have to be always an opposed combat check or a combat check against a set difficulty. It could be they're going through forms or they're trying to essentially talk while they're fighting or running through training sets. Or you could go completely, utterly Secret of Monkey Island and do insult sword fighting. And as they're fighting, they get bonuses based on the insults and retorts that they have.
Yeah.
Which would be a kind of cool way of doing it.
Yeah, and if our listeners don't want to take a trip down nostalgia lane and play Secret of Monkey Island, which I definitely recommend because it's still one of my favorite childhood games ever.
Oh, yeah.
You can actually find that exact same mechanic in The Witcher 3 in Blood and Wine, because you go down to the docks and do a fight club mission against a guy named Mancomb. You don't actually have to fight him at all if you just match him insult for insult. And it's amazing.
There are so many ways that you can be surprised as a GM by what your players are going to do. And by what your players try and do will then shape how any adventure you have with these players to do. When you're sitting down with friends, it's one thing. Like, you've got an idea of how your friends are. But I would also say that your friends, as you're drinking or socializing compatriots, they're different than how they're going to be around a table. You can see very different sides of people as you're sitting around talking to them and having them as a character.
Definitely, yeah. I actually ran into this a lot in my campaign because my girlfriend was playing and I was GMing. She talked over me a lot and I didn't like that. And she knows that I don't like being interrupted and talked over, but that side of her came out and she was like, "I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me." It can heighten certain characteristics of real people.
One of the things that I've found is, like, yes, as you're sitting down for your second adventure, your third adventure with the same group, yeah, starting up again is going to be so much quicker. The first time with any group, even the second time with any group, especially if they start switching characters, because then they've got the idea of this character in their head and they're trying to be true to this character, the first session is always going to be this weird little one-off. If you want to look at somewhere else that you can see this especially in network TV. Now, I know most people absolutely despise the concept of network TV, but it's got this really weird phenomena to it. And that's the pilot episode, where on a network TV show, the pilot episode is not representative of the TV show. The pilot episode is a movie that the production company does to get it on air. Then the second episode, or in some cases the third episode, is the real pilot. In some ways you can kind of see this, even going all the way back to Firefly. Because that one actually had two pilots, where you've got the actual pilot as it is on the DVD Blu-ray set, and you've got The Train Job, which is effectively a pilot, and that's how it was on network TV. And does kind of the same thing, almost sort of, in this case, lets the players recontextualize what they're doing, but this time the GM knows what's actually going on. Oh, we have to be this kind of character, or this kind of show instead of that kind of show. We've got to be this kind of adventure instead of that kind of adventure.
Yeah.
You're picking up on so many small little clues that the players are giving out, like, which of the NPCs in the first two sessions are they really paying attention to? Which ones are they interacting with? Do they sit down in front of one and they're just wanting to talk its ear off? And it's with this that you can start trying to figure out what is the adventure actually going to become? Because you've got your planning, but anything that hasn't happened at the table yet is malleable. And that is its best thing. Because you can always do rewrites.
You can do rewrites on the fly, too. Like, it is such a unique facet of tabletop gaming where if something doesn't go the way you expected, which it very often does, you can course correct in the moment instead of the way that I used to write when I was a teenager, where I would start writing a story and then something about the character would change as I was writing it, and it would take the story in a bizarre direction and I would have no clue how to fix it. I think in addition to the second session giving the GM a better idea of what to write for. The second session also gives the players more of an idea of what they're doing. The first session, or session zero, or whatever it is, they're going into this blind, pretty much, with just a stick figure drawing or a cardboard cutout that they've fashioned. They've got, like, a mental doll maker, and they've created this character, and they've got certain limitations because of that. And then they breathe life into this character by playing the character, and it transforms into something else. And then in the second session, they sort of settle into it more. It's less like driving a new car and more like driving your old jalopy, which you know inside and out. You know what every little rattle and click means.
That's actually kind of what I'm driving at. Characters are always that player's take on that character.
Yeah.
If I'm playing a fast-talking face-type character, it's going to be very different than most others. It's probably not going to be that good either, because I'm just not that sort of fast-talking person on the spot. As a GM, I've got no idea what style of these characters are coming at me. So I've got to figure out what my players are doing, and then I've got to figure out what I'm going to do with them.
Yeah.
And how I can then direct them in the direction I'm hoping to get them to go on. Even if it's the semi-silly idea of shoving them in the direction I don't want them to go.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, no, I absolutely don't want you to be taking a look at this haunted circus, because there's nothing interesting over there. There's no way that we could have an adventure going through there. And by doing that, then making the players just want to show me up and go there, and I put on a bit of an act.
Spite is a very good motivator.
Every person has her own thing that they like. The person who's really liking technical stuff isn't going to be really paying attention while you've got these NPCs up front, until the NPC is starting to talk about technical stuff.
Right.
Then once they do, that person is just on them.
Yeah.
But until that point, they're not exactly drifting off, but they're not really paying too good attention. It's so much of balancing that.
Because, like, if somebody has made a very technical character, and it's session zero, the session isn't made specifically or explicitly for a technical character, there's not going to be that much for the player to see that they can do. Unless they're a seasoned player who's like, oh, well, obviously I can find technical things to do no matter what.
This is sort of where it's an improvisational trick. I'm not quite sure where the heck I've learned it from. And I know it's in several different places, but the basic idea of when you have a player going and then asking them, why don't you describe this? Like, we enter into a room that this is essentially based around your character. Yeah, this is a mechanic's garage. You, the mechanic of the group, why don't you describe this for us? And it draws the player into it. Also, it's giving them permission to actually set things up in the game.
Sometimes players definitely do need permission. It might be an anxiety-based thing, but until somebody else does it, or until somebody tells you to do a thing, it feels like you don't have permission to do the thing. And so, you know, saying, oh, what does this look like? Or why don't you describe the shop for us? It gives them explicit permission to collaborate on the story, and because of that, gain a little bit more investment in the story, because they're helping flesh out the world.
It's kind of that twin thing that you just said. It gets the player investment and also gives them permission. The more investment they have, the longer you're able to run the campaign without it sputtering, kind of like what we talked in the last episode. Starting off with asking questions of the players of, okay, well, what's going on? What do you think that this NPC is doing? Trying to offload as many of the decisions that you're making onto them gives the players a lot of permission. It's when you need something to happen, that's when you metaphorically put your foot down saying, well, and this is what this character does. There was something that kind of got brought up earlier that I want to circle back to. Not having the charmer being the table lead, essentially, being the leader of the party. You were talking of having your transformed, almost like a Killer Croc or Hulk type, being the leader of the group because they're the moral core of the group. How would you deal with having, like, say, a fighter type being the main core of a group. They're going to be the first one that any of the NPCs that are out there are going to interact with. How would you deal with that?
I think at that point, I mean, honestly, I would leave it up to the player. Like, you don't have to script out any of the interactions with NPCs, which is, you know, the beauty of this medium. You don't have to worry about the fallout stats that your character has rubbing people the wrong way, unless you, as a player, intentionally or otherwise play your character that way. To use the same example, our transformed, he's just like big hulking gray guy whose powers are sort of a mutated form of cancer. So it's like rapid cell regeneration, and when he's struck, his body acts like a non-Newtonian fluid. So as it's hit, it hardens up and sort of becomes a bulbous tumor-like protrusion. And when he's relaxed, it's more fluid. And so he already looks kind of monstrous, but because it's masks, his house in the city, and everybody's used to seeing superheroes all around all the time. And there are just, like, vats of nuclear waste lying about the place for origin story purposes. There are obviously going to be some NPCs that would be put off by that, and it's reflected in the way that they talk. That's when the roles come in. That's when you have the character say something, and if it's particularly good, you know, you give them bonuses to rolling whatever they're rolling to convince somebody of one thing or another. Or the way that I would personally deal with it is in a narrative sense, like depending more so on the role-playing aspect and the improv aspect rather than the dice rolls. Because if the player says something really convincing and really sincere or earnest or, you know, reassuring, it would be the kind of thing that if I were writing a superhero show, it would work on that person. I would just have it work. So I think that is pretty much how I would apply it to any other system where it's like, it's based on how well it's improv'd or role-played. And then if their role-playing is not quite as good as it should be, then they have to roll. So that's would be when you end up with somebody saying, do this or I'll make things not so good for you. And then they make a roll and they actually succeed the roll, and that ended up being the most convincing thing that they could say.
Generally, I like that. Like, there's the adage that we just keep coming back to. Unless it matters, don't roll.
Yeah.
So that means you're handling a lot of stuff narratively. But it also helps if, as a player, if you can drop into your role when you're doing interactions, it helps. As a GM, if you can drop into your character, it helps. Or at least react in how the character is going to react. Like, if you see this big hulking Wookiee and you're playing an Imperial, chances are you're going to be a little on the derisive side.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter what the Wookiee's saying, if you can even understand the Wookiee, unlike some stormtroopers. You can meet so many people on the sidewalk, talking to them, and they are people. Like, and they're just people. In a normal conversation, there's no reason that, well, this person is highly charming and therefore they're going to be able to get more out of you if you're just having a normal conversation.
Yeah.
If you're wanting to ask basic questions. Whereas if you are attempting to actually charm them, if you are trying to seduce them, if you are trying to coerce them, then that's when a skill set is applied. I guess that's kind of how I deal with it. It's like having different approaches happen as the table lead. It's just different approaches. If, say, the Mandalorian commando walks in to talk with the Hutt is probably going to be looking upon them as a gladiator or a bounty hunter instead of being the leader of this small contingent of special forces.
Yeah.
And it's at that point where maybe the actual talky one, the one who actually does have a higher charisma, that does have some ranks in charm, that's when they're going to step up and actually do the flattery of working with people.
That sort of harkens back to what I was saying about having the fighter convincing the veteran warrior character. Because a talkie character is going to be able to deal with a shrewd business hut a lot more easily than a no-nonsense, straight-to-the-point Mandalorian.
Personally, I'm a huge fan of using odd rolls for things. Say you have two mechanics getting together and they're in a junk shop. Having the two of them roll mechanics to feel each other out in their areas of expertise, like this one's a swoop racer mechanic and this one's a starship mechanic. As they start talking, it's a discussion about different applications of engines or of reaction controls.
Yeah.
To most people, this sounds absolutely, bafflingly boring. But to two techs, it's amazing.
Using those skills, I think, is another good way to encourage players. If you go strictly by the book for something like that, and you use only perception to feel somebody out, or you use only charm, and your character is not built for charm, it kind of dissuades the player from taking chances and doing things like that, which otherwise might be beneficial for the character later on. Having the mechanic character bonding with another mechanic to get on their good side, it wouldn't work if the character had to rely on a low charm roll or a low perception roll. But it would make sense to apply that to mechanics, because that's what they're good at, and that's the whole basis of them bonding with this NPC.
As a GM, I'd love to have five players with five different hammers that they're always trying to find nails for. One person with a hammer, one person with a screwdriver, this person with a monkey wrench, that person with a hacksaw because I don't know why. This person here with the molding putty, because apparently that's a thing.
Yeah, it is.
Having these five little things that this is the only thing they're good at, and if they aren't in their own little cocoon of being awesome, they're not willing to try.
It's like the downside of min-maxing in most games.
Sometimes, yeah, this person is the highly specialized Mandalorian commando who can slice through anything because of this sword that's been passed down through generations, and no, I'm not going to dang well say it.
A very Arthurian sword, one might say.
Just because a character is good at something doesn't mean they can't be okay at other things. And yes, I know that, hey look, a human is got two greens and everything. At the very least, they've got two greens.
Yeah.
That's not a horrible roll, because you flip a destiny point,
you make it a yellow and a green.
At least on an average check, that's not bad. Even on a hard, that's doable. Scrounge for some boosts. And as a GM, I love giving out boosts, as long as the players are wanting them.
As long as they give a good argument for it.
Exactly.
I am absolutely willing to hand out blues. The problem that I get into with players busking for blues, to give it a nice alliterative term, is when they do it just because they want the blue and not because they think they deserve the blue. And so that's when we end up with, the mechanic saying, oh, do I get a blue on this roll because I have my trusty droid with me? Or can I get a blue because I'm particularly cute, which has happened in the past.
Ooh.
And those are the times when it's like, okay, I know that this is for fun, but are you really taking this seriously?
It's at that point where I grew up as one of those annoying, annoying kids who would answer a question with a question. Because I have my trusty droid here, can I get that blue? It's like, well, how is the droid helping you?
Yeah.
Me as a GM, I'm willing to accept almost any answer other than, well, my droid helps me. Like, if it's just a fairly bland answer where they're not trying to think of the actual action, just checking off, I get a blue from this one, and I get blue from that one, I get blue from this. If it's just a checkbox, I'm not really interested in saying yes.
Yeah.
If it's, my droid is helping me by bringing me a bunch of equipment that I wouldn't normally be able to get. All right, fine. You get a blue.
When it's just a checkbox, it's like they're not actually doing it for the story's sake. They're just doing it for success's sake. Whereas, like, one of the great things about Powered by the Apocalypse as a system, and I guess this can apply to Fantasy Flight as well, every failure brings with it some new aspect to the story. So Powered by the Apocalypse, specifically in Masks, every time you fail, you get a progression. So the only way that you can level up your character is by failing or by doing specific things outside of combat. And so it's not just an XP for points. It's not a leveling up in a traditional sense sort of system. In Fantasy Flight games, every time that you get a threat, something else happens in the story.
Exactly.
Every time you get an advantage, something else happens in the story. And sure, sometimes you can be at a loss and be like, oh, well, I can't think of anything else for that advantage to do, so you'll get a boost die on the next one and you can explain why later. Or I can't think of anything for this threat to be just yet, so just take a black die because you're stressed out. It gives you opportunities to enrich the story with human failure, because if all you do is succeed, you're not learning from mistakes and you're not really having a relatable story.
Just today, I was having a bit of a conversation like this with one of our listeners on Twitter. A failure should almost never be the end of a story. It may be the end of that approach to finishing something, but it never should be the full end. It may be a wrong piece of information that sends you off on a bit of a wild goose chase. It may be adding extra steps in the way. Even in combat, technically a failure is not the absence of action. It's just not the inclusion of action you are wanting with a satisfactory ending.
Yeah.
Say you're doing a melee combat roll, because apparently I've got that on the brain. As you are slicing with this vibro sword and you fail the roll, you're not just sort of standing there quivering with this sword raised, waiting to strike until you finally are able to. You are striking and you are not successfully hitting. There is still action going on in the scene.
If you're watching a choreographed fight scene, not every single swing connects with a hit.
And sometimes that's what failure is, not connecting. Not shooting the stormtrooper in the chest. As a GM, you can bring this out. And as you as a GM bring this out, your players will start bringing this out. Again, kind of going back to what Becca was saying. Permission. As you as a GM are showing off by examples what you can do at the table, that is what your players will understand can be done.
As a little slightly relevant aside, since I'm thinking about masks again, if you're running an FFG Star Wars game and you're running into that problem of not knowing what to do with those threats or advantages, take a look at masks or Monster of the Week, or I don't remember what the other one that I'm playing is. Take a look at some Powered by the Apocalypse games, because they usually have a list of things for when you fail a roll. So, like, if you fail completely, such and such happens. If you succeed, but within a specific margin, it's unstable or temporary, or you create an opportunity for your enemy to attack you, or, you know, you leave yourself open to attack, or something like that. You may not be using those system rules, but you can use those ideas so that the next time you do that melee attack with a vibro sword and miss with a threat, you can have that ready and say, oh, well, the threat is that you've opened yourself up to attack and the enemy gets a blue die on their next attack towards you, or you get a black die to defending or something like that.
That's a great way of looking at it. And you talking about that reminds me of, as most of our listeners know, there's a new system that is very Star Wars role-playing adjacent. It is called the Genesis system from FFG. It's essentially taking the Star Wars role-playing game and filing the numbers off. One of the things that they put out as of recording last Friday, and yeah, there's going to be a link in the show notes, there was a table put up of social advantages and threats, and obviously triumphs and despairs. So you all know the tables. It's just, they had one up for social interactions. In spirit, it is very much like the combat one that we all have. It's in the GM screens. It's in even the beginner boxes. The combat one is widely distributed. This social one is the first time I've seen it. It gives ideas on just mechanically, like little semi-mechanical things of what's going on. Like, okay, you've pulled two threat during a social encounter. This time you're going to give off one of your base motivations of what you're wanting out of this scene. Okay, I'm looking for this out of my own greed. Or your NPC is. Like, the reason why I'm arguing so hard about not giving you any deal on this is because my shop just doesn't have the money to do that. And you're worried about that. The article, the post, also goes into a little bit of that idea of, like, what Beck is saying. Trying to find all these different places of where you can crib notes of, we've got ideas on what mechanically we can do. Two threat means you take a setback die on your next roll. A advantage means you can recover a strain or give a bouncing boost to the next player that goes. Stuff like that. We know the mechanics, but having ideas. Yeah, crib from Masks, crib from Starjammer, or crib from Starfinder, which was actually the one I was thinking.
Crib from wherever helps.
For starting off your characters, for starting off your adventures, for getting an idea of how things are, and how to draw in your players so that they're more wanting to be at the table instead of being entertained by you. In this episode, we've been talking about a bunch of different things that are all on the same basic theme. How do you get people at the table to be part of the story going on, even when it doesn't initially appear that they should be? Like, why would the Kuzo Heavy with heavy blaster rifle, why would they be part of the business negotiation? But you can also flip that, and why wouldn't they be? My own final thought on all this is, if you don't know your players well, you need to find out how they're going to react. So you need to give them essentially stock or fairly safe and standard ways for them to show up. So yeah, having the standard bar fight, having a person they have to talk to, and seeing how the table dynamic starts to grow. Because the table lead and the amazingly good person at social skills might not be the same. I mean, they could end up like the A-team, where you've got the planner and the person who's really good at social skills being two completely different people, one of which is Bradley Cooper.
My final thought is to encourage your players to branch out of their comfort zones as dictated by their character sheet. Like, don't discourage a certain character from doing something simply because the rules say that they're bad at charisma. I mean, as we said in one of the previous episodes, just make up your own rules, you know? Like, the rules are just guidelines. They're just a framework for you to work off of. And if you find something that works better for you, like if your mechanic wants to charm another mechanic using their mechanic skills, that's totally fine. If that works for you, do it. You don't need to kowtow to something that some other guy wrote in a book because, you know, they just made it up themselves. As we've said repeatedly, the point is to have fun. And it's not fun to be met with failure constantly because you're not made to be a charismatic character. Just play up your player's strengths, your player character's strengths, and if you're lucky, you might end up with a team like My Masks group, where every single one of us gets to be the face of the party with different NPCs, and you get to see how spectacularly that goes, whether it's for better or for worse. You could have somebody really antagonistic actually succeed at something when your usual party face is a very meek, good-hearted, very kind boy. No. Really, it's fine. We were in the area, literally passing by. It was no trouble. Yep. Okay. I'm losing you. We're going through a tunnel or something. Bye. I click off the comms and sit back in the navigator's chair. Well, that wasn't quite as exciting as solving a trap puzzle, but I will admit blowing up a raider was pretty fun.
I was really expecting a light cruiser to show up. Or, you know, maybe one of those interdictors that those weirdos at Chopper Base were talking about. You never just blow up a raider, at least I don't. There's hardly any sport to it. Sure, they're fast, but they just go poof and those three wings go flipping around in space. Tune in next week as we spring the trap in Tales from the Hydean Way. You can find show updates on Twitter at The Hydean Way, and I'm at Deuterium Ice.
And I'm at Shadowblinder without an E. We're at theheidiandway.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to things we talk about in the show, and our live play podcast, Heroes of the Heidi and Way. Our podcast is on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, where you can find more episodes and help us out by rating and reviewing us.
Drop us a holocom at tales@theheidiandway.com. We're also on Facebook as Tales from the Heidi and Way. If you like what we do and want to support the show, you can find us at patreon.com/theheidiandway.